Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Wilson, and I am really excited to get into this week's sources. We have an absolutely incredible stack here detailing exactly how political instability from Washington all the way to Westminster is, well, it's crashing into global finance, security, and even rewriting the essential rules of childhood. Our mission, as always, is to give you the most efficient shortcut possible to being well-informed. This deep dive is based on a full reading of The Economist for the week of December 6th to December 12th, 2025.
And I'm Ronnie Beddoes, here to synthesize that information and, connect the dots for you. And this is a critical one because we're really looking at two huge themes. First, how political fragility, especially in the U.S. and Europe, is fundamentally impacting international security. And second, a fascinating, maybe a little terrifying, exploration of how artificial intelligence is rewriting the rules for trust, for verifiable fact, and the very way children develop.
That sounds like a powerful combination. You've got geopolitical crisis on one hand and this massive technological upheaval on the other. Okay, let's unpack this immediately. Let's start right in the deep end with some of these high-stakes international crises. We have to begin with a story that has absolutely stunned legal and foreign policy analysts. I'm talking about President Trump's decision regarding the U.S. drug war.
Yes.
Yeah.
The pardon of Juan Orlando Hernandez, or JOH. The details are truly jaw-dropping.
Just to remind everyone, JOH is the former Honduran president. He was convicted in the U.S. just last year for conspiring to import cocaine.
Right. He was handed a 45-year sentence. And now he's a free man. Trump claimed he was unfairly treated.
The timing here is just, it's everything, isn't it?
It's essential to understand in the move. This clemency was issued just before the Honduran presidential elections on November 30th.
And Trump publicly endorsed a candidate, a conservative, Nasri Asfura.
He did, hoping to thwart what the White House specifically branded as narco-communists from winning.
Narco-communists. We should probably clarify that's a highly charged political term.
Oh, absolutely. It's pure political rhetoric, not a neutral description. It's designed to activate a specific base, reviving that Cold War imagery of a communist threat, but blending it with the very real threat of cartels.
So the calculation was political. Pardon JOH, and that boosts your chosen candidate.
That was the idea. But the political reality on the ground was completely different. JOH is so universally unpopular in Honduras, even among conservatives, that Asfura, the candidate Trump backed, he had to quickly distance himself, emphasizing they had no ties whatsoever.
So the intervention was impulsive based on a faulty political read, and it just backfired.
Completely. Asfura was trailing the center-right candidate, Salvador Nasalla, when these sources went to press. But the biggest implication here, the real story, is what this does to the coherence of the entire anti-drug war policy.
Right, because you have two dramatically opposed policies operating at the exact same time.
Exactly. Why pardon a convicted trafficker, freeing him after the justice system spent years amassing all this evidence, while at the same time authorizing lethal action against suspected runners at sea?
That paradox is the key takeaway, isn't it? The strategic incoherence.
It is. And it absolutely enraged the law enforcement community. An official at the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, actually called the move lunacy.
Lunacy.
You have to imagine, after all the years of painstaking, dangerous work by agents to build that case against JOH.
And what was Trump's rationale? Did he give one?
The pardon seems rooted in Trump's expressed belief that he and JOH were victims of a shared political persecution by radical leftist forces.
Which is strange because the U.S. investigation against JOH actually started during Trump's first term.
Precisely. Yet his stated rationale was that the conviction was a setup by the Biden administration. He also said that prosecuting a former head of state sets a dangerous precedent, and he explicitly linked it to the threat facing other leaders like Venezuela's Maduro.
So that inconsistency is just dramatically amplified when we look at the other side of this coin.
Right, the anti-drug operation itself.
Let's shift to that. The Caribbean anti-drug campaign controversy, led by America's Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, the scope is shocking.
It is. 21 confirmed airstrikes against suspected smuggling boats. At least 83 people killed, many of them seemingly civilian smugglers. And this is all happening with very, very little oversight from Congress.
And the controversy has now escalated beyond just the scope, right? There's an allegation of a war crime.
A very serious one. From the outset of the campaign on September 2nd, an initial missile strike against a vessel left two survivors clinging to the wreckage.
Okay, so they were incapacitated.
Exactly. Or out of action, as the laws of war define them. Admiral Frank Bradley, the Special Operations Commander, then ordered a follow-up strike that killed them.
Wow. That sounds like a gross violation of standard protocol. But is there any plausible operational reason for that? Maybe if the vessel was still loaded with contraband?
That operational concern does not supersede the explicit law of armed conflict. The law mandates the protection of combatants who are out of action or shipwrecked. The legal implications are stark.
And experts are weighing in on this.
Oh, yes. Stephen Lepper, a former high-ranking Air Force lawyer, called killing survivors of an attack at sea the textbook definition of an unlawful order. The Pentagon's own manual on the law of armed conflict calls attacking incapacitated persons inhumane.
And what was the official justification? I heard something about a navigation hazard.
That's the argument, yes. The admiral reportedly justified the follow-up strike as necessary to remove a potential navigation hazard.
And how is that holding up?
Legal experts immediately dismissed it as a legally dubious rationalization.
Huh.
International treaty law prioritizes providing care for the wounded over removing a navigation hazard. It's not even close.
So this seems to point to a broader issue with Secretary Hegseth's approach.
A much broader contempt for the laws of war. Hegseth has actively gutted the Pentagon's Civilian Harm Mitigation Office. He's fired senior judge advocate generals, the JAGs, the military lawyers.
So the very people who provide legal counsel are being pushed out?
Yes, and morale in the J Corps is reportedly collapsing. The lawyers are focusing less on the letter of the law and more on trying to reverse engineer what the administration wants to hear.
Which brings us back to the biggest question. Do these drug boats even justify this level of force to begin with?
Exactly. As one former JAG who advised on these operations noted, narco gangs are not Al-Qaeda or Islamic State. They are a criminal enterprise, not a national army.
So when the administration is willing to bomb suspected smugglers, but then immediately pardon the man who ran a proven narco state.
The entire foreign policy posture is revealed as strategically self-defeating and ethically bankrupt. That dissonance is just impossible to resolve.
And that strategic incoherence in the U.S., it has a direct impact on global alliances, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Mm-hmm. Let's move from those U.S. paradoxes to European flinching, specifically regarding the war in Ukraine. The U.S. consensus has been blown apart by the Trump administration, forcing Europe to shoulder this huge $90 to $100 billion annual burden.
This is Europe's moment of truth, and frankly, they are struggling badly. They have three huge strategic tasks.
Okay, what are they?
One, convince Putin that Europe's resolve is permanent. Two, reassure Kyiv that funding will be predictable. And three, demonstrate to MAGA Republicans in the U.S. that Europe is not the feeble, free-riding bloc they claim it is.
And how are they doing?
Currently, they're falling short on all three fronts.
Yeah.
Mostly due to internal squabbling.
Nothing highlights that failure more than the issue of the frozen Russian assets, right?
The 210 billion euros, yes. Roughly $245 billion. The G7 agreed last year to use the interest generated by these assets, a few billion a year, to support Ukraine.
Which is just a drop in the bucket compared to what's needed.
It is. It is simply not enough to cover a $100 billion annual financing hole.
So what's the more creative, impactful idea that's being stalled?
The proposal was to use the principal of those frozen assets to collateralize a massive reparations loan to Ukraine.
Okay, so a loan backed by the frozen Russian money.
Right. And the loan would only be paid back if Russia eventually pays compensation. This would immediately inject, maybe, $50 billion into Kyiv's budget.
That sounds like a decisive, smart mechanism, so why is it stalled?
It boils down to a risk-sharing debate. Belgium, where a lot of the money is lodged through Euroclear, wants other member states to share the risk that Russia might sue to get the assets back.
And that could leave Belgian taxpayers on the hook.
Potentially. And Germany and France, on the other hand, are worried about setting a precedent that might cause other nations to pull their central bank reserves out of Europe.
So bureaucratic procrastination is playing right into the hands of Europe's critics.
And crucially, into Putin's hands.
And the consequence of this dribs and drabs approach, is punishing for Kyiv.
It creates a state of perpetual anxiety. Ukraine is forced to live from one donor meeting to the next. They can't do predictable multi-year financing for their military, for manufacturing shells, for rebuilding power plants before winter.
Which feeds Putin's strategy of just waiting out the West.
Perfectly. It provides ammunition to Trump supporters who claim Europe is incapable of serious statecraft.
We saw evidence of this hardening stance during the recent peace talks, didn't we?
We did. U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff's talks in Moscow. They thankfully fizzled out.
Mm.
But Putin is clearly emboldened by his recent battlefield games, and he's hardening his demands.
What are those demands now?
Kremlin sources indicated three key points. One, further territorial claims in the Donbas. Two, a permanent cap on the size of Ukraine's army. And three, full recognition of occupied lands as Russian territory.
Which are, in a word, intolerable.
Intolerable for Ukraine and for Europe, yes. So no diplomatic resolution is remotely possible under those terms.
So the war will just grind on.
It will. Although a Ukrainian official tried to put a positive spin on it, calling it a spiral of peace circling, but upward, the immediate outlook is continued conflict. It's a test of financial endurance, and right now, Europe is failing that test.
Let's pivot to the Middle East, to Syria, which is marking a transition year. Bashar al-Assad fled on December 8, 2024. His successor, Ahmed al-Shara, a former jihadist leader, has, maybe surprisingly, managed to avoid total chaos.
It is surprising. Syria has not become the hardline Islamic caliphate that critics predicted. Bars are open, women are not forced to cover up, and Shara has ended Syria's diplomatic isolation with startling speed. He's become a fixture at international conferences.
So on the surface, it looks like pragmatic leadership.
On the surface, yes. But if you scratch that surface, cracks are definitely beginning to show in how he's governing. He seems completely uninterested in rebuilding the formal state infrastructure.
What's he doing instead?
He's creating what analysts are calling parallel structures. These are run by his loyalists and cronies, completely bypassing the established bureaucracy.
So he's not fixing the old state, he's building a new shadow government.
That's a good way to put it. He established new bodies, like a general authority for borders and customs, and a sovereign wealth fund, all by presidential decree.
Which effectively strips the formal ministries of their power.
It strips them of their revenue-raising power, yes. It puts tax income, customs duties, all the main sources of state revenue directly into the hands of a small circle of his confidants. And these new structures, they operate without any public oversight or a clear legal basis.
So highly susceptible to corruption.
Extremely. So while he looks like a deft diplomat on the world stage, internally, he's just consolidating personal power and refusing to implement the foundational governance reforms that you need for long-term stability.
And that governance style must be fueling distrust among minority groups.
That's the major flaw of his regime. Shara says all the right words about Syria's mosaic of faiths, Alawites, Druze, Christians, but he has done almost nothing to genuinely reassure them. Power is still overwhelmingly concentrated among a handful of his close relatives and tribesmen.
And his security forces have acted brutally, which would only confirm their worst fears.
They have. Pro-government forces committed just atrocious massacres against Alawites in March and Druze in July. Alawites in particular have borne the brunt of layoffs and subsidy cuts. Hundreds of thousands of ex-civil servants are now jobless. They feel completely disconnected from this new political order.
And that creates fertile ground for dissent. Is this translating into whispers of a new insurgency?
It is. Whispers of a new Alawite rebellion are getting louder. Calls to arms are circulating among former regime officers.
Really?
Yes, like the notorious militia commander Mohammed Jabbar. He's part of a network actively trying to foment rebellion against Shara. There were reports of shadowy NGOs linked to them distributing stipends, even setting up small training camps.
But has it gained any real traction?
Not yet. They've failed to get significant political cover abroad. And frankly, most Alawites fear another massacre more than they desire another war. But the underlying tensions, they remain explosive. Shara has to quickly realize he is, as one source put it, running a state now, not a terror outfit.
And that requires rebuilding institutions, not parallel structures. It's a fascinating through line how these international political tensions echo so loudly in domestic political fragility. Which brings us perfectly to the fragmentation we're seeing in the UK. Britain's first-past-the-post voting system is, you know, theoretically designed to lead to stable government. But what we're seeing now is the complete opposite.
It is. The sources are calling it slot machine politics, where fragmentation means elections are just a wildly unpredictable gamble.
The relationship between votes cast and seats won is just completely broken.
It owes more to the randomness of a casino now than to stable constitutional theory. We looked at a detailed model using 80 years of electoral data, 10,001 simulations. And the volatility is truly unprecedented. In some constituencies, seats could potentially be won on as little as 23% of the vote.
23%? That is an extreme minority of the electorate determining who represents them.
It really speaks to the deep fragmentation caused by the rise of these medium-sized parties, particularly Reform UK. The models suggest Reform is likely to be the largest party, but its possible seat tally spans a massive range.
How big of a range?
From 112 seats all the way up to 373. And that enormous variance is the difference between Nigel Farage leading a prominent opposition or becoming the next prime minister.
And that volatility just fuels disillusionment among voters. The practical result is what they call a mandate problem.
Yes, because governments elected on such small vote shares, they don't have the political authority for sweeping necessary reforms. It's a lose-lose scenario.
Mm-hmm.
If they take harsh measures, they're accused of failing to reflect the majority. If they do nothing, their own supporters accuse them of making empty manifesto promises.
And the consequence is weaker governance and, frankly, growing contempt for parliament.
It's clear. And Prime Minister Keir Starmer's reaction to this volatility is highly telling. He acknowledged that voters feel frustrated, but he worries far more about the populist threat of a reform government led by Farage. He claims it would ruin Britain economically, destroy its global standing.
And he used some pretty strong language, claiming a reform government would be pro-Putin or Putin neutral.
He did. And he contrasted this with a conservative government, which he said he can sleep at night under.
Which creates its own political friction, doesn't it? Starmer, the Labour leader, effectively accepting the Tories as allies against this populist threat.
It risks alienating his own base. But the underlying driver propelling reform is this feeling that the Westminster system simply no longer responds to what voters want. The pressure for electoral reform, which is already supported by a majority of Britons, might eventually become irresistible.
Because the current system has broken down. It's a slot machine where the outcome feels purely random.
Exactly.
The challenges facing democracy aren't just structural, though. They're fundamentally technological, and they're rooted in trust. Let's shift to the threat facing the integrity of opinion polls themselves.
This is a huge one. Large language models, LLMs, are now capable of answering surveys completely undetected. It threatens to turn public opinion polls into what our sources call gibberish.
It's a silent existential threat to survey research.
For years, pollsters relied on simple verification methods, you know, asking if a respondent had been elected president to screen out obvious bots. That approach is now obsolete.
And there's research to back this up.
Yes. Sean Westwood of Dartmouth College built an AI survey agent to test this. He created highly detailed demographic profiles for the AI to answer questions as if it were a specific type of human.
And the AI's success rate in passing quality checks was, frankly, terrifying.
It passed 99.8% of common data quality checks. And crucially, it was designed to mask its identity by feigning errors.
How so?
It would struggle slightly with questions that required, say, a higher level of education, perfectly mimicking the behavior of a real human with a lower educational background. This means traditional verification methods are now completely useless.
So we've moved past simple bots to highly sophisticated AI impersonators. And that's where the risk of manipulation comes in, right? If simple cues can sway the AI responses.
Absolutely. Westwood found that by giving the AI a very subtle instruction, just telling it not to be negative toward China, the agent flipped its geopolitical assessment. 88% of the time, it responded that Russia, not China, was America's greatest military threat.
So a malicious actor could use similar cues to mislead officials on key policy debates or, more dangerously, sway elections.
Directly.
How small of an intervention would it take to flip an election result?
Alarmingly small. Across 7 national polls before the 2024 election, a tiny number, somewhere between just 10 and 52 AI respondents, would have been enough to flip the headline result from Trump to Harris or vice versa.
That is a shockingly small number.
It is. And it's not just grand geopolitical campaigns. Petty fraudsters are also incentivized. They're scaling up fake responses to get the gift cards or payment many polling firms offer.
What about solutions? Are there any?
Well, one suggestion is requiring physical verification, maybe on camera. But experts warn that will eventually become trivial for AI to defeat through synthetic video. More immediately, it risks creating a significant amount of selection bias.
Can you break down selection bias simply for us here?
It just means the group of people who agree to verify themselves physically are often different from the general population. People who distrust authority or technology would just opt out.
So the poll would only capture the views of those comfortable with that kind of tracking.
And that in itself distorts the true public sentiment. The industry is facing a really difficult dilemma here. How do you measure public opinion when authenticity is so easily faked?
Moving to the U.S. domestic political landscape, we have the ongoing healthcare headache. specifically the expiring enhanced subsidies for the Affordable Care Act marketplaces.
Right. These supercharged tax credits are set to expire at the end of December. And this matters because the Congressional Budget Office estimates this could cause 3.5 million people to become uninsured by 2027.
And these subsidies made insurance affordable for a lot of middle-income Americans.
The millions of them who were previously priced out. Letting them lapse means potentially forcing all those people back off the rolls.
But politically, there seems to be support for extending them.
There is. Three-quarters of Americans support extending the boosted subsidies, and that includes 44% of self-identified MAGA Republicans. It shows significant public consensus.
So why is there a bitter impasse in Congress?
It's fractured by two issues. One is concern over the $350 billion extension cost, and the other, critically, is anti-abortion activists.
How does the abortion issue tie into healthcare subsidies?
Well, anti-abortion activists want tax credits to stop funding any health plan that covers abortion. Now, the ACA already has complicated rules to prevent federal funds from directly paying for abortion, but the activists want absolute assurance, often demanding riders that would fundamentally change the law's structure.
So despite broad popular support, political infighting means expiry is the most likely outcome.
That's the tragic irony. Neither side has the political appetite to fracture their coalition over this, and they can't pass an extension without Democratic votes. So expiry is just the path of least resistance for a gridlocked Congress.
And amid this headache, we're seeing some truly radical proposals surface.
Senator Rick Scott's proposal is particularly radical. Inspired by a Trump consultation, the idea is to give the cash value of the subsidy directly to Americans, bypassing the insurance market entirely.
And what would that do?
Experts warn that this move would almost certainly cause the ACA marketplace in those states to collapse into a death spiral.
Can you explain that concept of a death spiral for us?
Sure. A death spiral occurs when only the sickest people, those who desperately need the coverage, buy insurance. Healthy people, if they just get a cash handout, would no longer participate.
And without the healthy people to spread the risk and costs.
Insurance premiums would just become prohibitively expensive for everyone remaining, leading to the collapse of the insurance pools in those states. It's a policy designed to fail the marketplace it claims to fix.
Let's pivot quickly to a new, heavily branded domestic policy, the Trump accounts. These are new investment accounts for children born between 2025 and 2028.
Right. They receive a $1,000 deposit from the government, and the name is already secured in the tax code, much like the Roth IRA.
And families can contribute more, tax-free.
Yes, another $5,000 each year until the child turns 18. Now, the White House has made some heroic, headline-grabbing claims about the potential growth.
I saw one of those, that the accounts could be worth $1.9 million by the time the child turns 28.
Which sounds astronomical, because it is. That figure would require American equity markets to return about 15% annually for almost 30 years straight.
Which is historically implausible.
Extremely. The more plausible reality, assuming historical average returns, is under half that, maybe yielding a pot worth around $400,000. But the important math is this. Virtually all of that money would come from the family's contributions, the government's initial $1,000 deposit. That would grow to maybe $6,000 by age 28.
So the policy is less about a real government intervention and more about political branding.
Precisely. It's a piece of political branding where, as the sources suggest, a good name makes up for a lot, giving voters the impression of radical wealth building when the real driver is sustained private savings.
That is a fascinating look at the interplay between government fiscal woes and political spectacle. Speaking of spectacle, let's transition from federal finances to the bizarre localized culture wars defining local politics, specifically over noisy technology. It's truly bizarre that leaf blowers have become a partisan issue, but here we are in the middle of the landscaping wars. Over 160 U.S. cities now ban petrol-powered leaf blowers.
And the complaints are multi-layered and legitimate. These tools are offensively loud at a frequency that penetrates walls and windows. It's a real issue for remote workers and elderly residents.
But it's not just the noise, it's the environmental impact.
The impact of their noxious two-stroke engines is horrific. using a single blower for just 1 hour emits as much particulate matter as driving 1,100 miles.
That's an incredible statistic, 1,100 miles.
Yes, according to the California Air Resources Board, they stir up allergens, mold spores, toxic dust. It's a real health hazard.
But the politics are sticky, aren't they? Especially for small landscaping businesses.
That's the friction point. The bans skew heavily to the left. In Lower Merion Township, a wealthy Philadelphia suburb that just passed a ban, over 75% of voters supported Kamala Harris. These are residents seeking quiet and less pollution.
And conservatives take a different view.
A strong libertarian view, yes. They prefer not to limit property owners' rights, and they're defending small business owners against restrictive government regulations.
And this has escalated beyond just local squabbling.
It has. Republican-run states like Texas and Georgia have passed laws banning municipalities from treating petrol and electric tools differently. It's a move to preempt local control. The political logic is clear. Noise abatement is framed as an elitist intrusion on freedom, turning a simple appliance into a symbol of the national partisan split.
Okay, let's pivot from loud, annoying tools to the quiet, profound revolution happening in children's lives. We're hearing that 2025 has been declared the year of AI for toy makers.
Yes, AI is becoming pervasive in education, games, and companionship. The promise here is almost utopian. AI offers every child the kind of bespoke upbringing previously available only to the extremely rich.
You mean private tutors, personalized syllabuses, that kind of thing?
Exactly. And custom entertainment. Children listening to songs composed about them or reading stories in which they star, all perfectly tailored to their skill level and interests.
And we have hard data showing dramatic success with this, particularly in the developing world.
We do. Google's read-along app in India, for example, showed participants were 60% likelier to improve their proficiency. Microsoft's Copilot in Nigeria led to students improving their English by the equivalent of nearly 2 years of ordinary schooling.
That sounds like an incredible force for educational equity.
It does. But a bespoke upbringing can also be a lonely and atomized one. There are critical hidden traps that risk creating adults who are ill-equipped for real life.
Okay, let's break down those traps.
The sources highlight three. The first is the echo chamber effect. Social media already feeds adults views they agree with. AI threatens to lock children into these chambers at an early stage, giving them a favorites-only diet.
So the child who loves horses will only ever get horse stories.
And this stamps out serendipity. The child may never learn to tolerate or engage with the unfamiliar, which is a crucial part of cultural literacy.
And that feeds into the second trap, the social skill deficit.
Yes. AI companions are, by their nature, perfect partners. They never criticize, they never challenge, they never share complex, unpredictable feelings of their own. This is inherently poor preparation for dealing with imperfect humans.
And we're already seeing a preference for this.
We are. One-third of American teenagers find chatting to an AI companion at least as satisfying as talking to a friend and easier than talking to their parents. If children aren't used to taking turns, compromising, or handling mild friction, they could grow up unable to collaborate or, you know, navigate a relationship.
The AI optimizes for comfort, while reality optimizes for conflict and compromise.
The third point is the urgent need for safety countermeasures. The technology evolves so fast that guardrails are difficult to set. We need strict, properly enforced age restrictions for chatbots. And the peril of these personalized partners going rogue is very real.
And we saw that really unsettling anecdote about the AI teddy bear.
Yes. The AI teddy recently found to have spiced up its chat with talk of kinky sex. It just underscores the immediate safety challenge. And for teachers, the system is already broken. They can't trust homework written at home anymore.
So more in-school assessment becomes essential.
Just to verify, the student actually did the work. Child development experts have warned that we simply do not know how these perfect partners will change human brains and human interactions long term.
But we are seeing a massive market boom for these products, particularly from Asia.
Correct. Chinese firms are leading the boom. Companies like FoloToy saw annual online sales growth of over 400%. This reflects significantly higher Chinese trust in AI, 72% versus just 32% in America.
That's a huge difference.
It is. The long-term challenge for Western parents and educators is figuring out how to preserve the essential messiness and unpredictability of human socialization that AI risks rubbing out of children's lives.
This shift in childhood development leads us directly to the labor market. The skills children learn now will define the jobs they hold later. So, which white-collar jobs is AI already targeting?
The two standouts are computer programming and customer service.
And the disruption is already dramatic. Two-thirds of coders use an AI tool weekly. GitHub Copilot alone has 26 million users.
Right. And on the customer service side, 85% of managers plan to experiment with AI this year. It's why the share price of outsourcers like Teleperformance has slid 75% since ChatGPT's launch.
So the key question for you, the listener, is what links these seemingly disparate roles? If we understand why AI works here, we can predict where it will spread next.
There are three commonalities. First, they are jobs that are relatively context-light. A programmer can write a function for a task without needing deep insight into the company's 10-year product strategy. A call center agent deals with problems contained within a specific transaction.
Okay, so limited organizational knowledge is needed. What's number two?
Second, the results are easily verifiable. This is crucial. Programmers can run tests on code to ensure it works. Supervisors can easily check if a customer's problem was resolved. If you can verify the result quickly, you can deploy AI faster.
And the third factor is a massive amount of data.
An abundance of training data. GitHub Copilot had an almost infinite repository of code to learn from. Call centers have years of recorded, transcribed calls. These vast data repositories allow the AI to constantly improve.
So if you look for other knowledge jobs that fit those three criteria, context light, verifiable, and data rich,
you can quickly draw a straight line to areas like technical writing, some paralegal work, and certain accounting tasks.
Before we move entirely into finance, we need to address a specific, highly aggrieved demographic in Britain, the avocados.
A great nickname. It refers to youngish people, university entrants between 2012 and 2023. They're the victims of crushing academic debt, compounded by high housing costs and life interrupted by lockdown.
They are paying a phenomenal penalty for having gone to university.
The squeeze is phenomenal. Let's look at the numbers. An avocado, maybe with a master's degree on a modest salary of £30,000, faces an exorbitant marginal tax rate of 43%.
43%? How is that possible?
It's due to frozen income tax thresholds combined with frozen student loan repayment points, which demand 9% of all earnings above that threshold.
So the marginal rate, what they lose on every new pound earned, is effectively 43 pence. That is crushing.
Now, compare that same person to a pensioner over 66 in the exact same job. They would pay just 20% in tax because they're exempt from national insurance.
So the student loan system is effectively a punitive age-based tax.
It is. And a non-graduate would have to earn more than three times as much before they paid a higher marginal rate than that avocado on £30,000. It creates a deep sense of intergenerational inequity.
But what's truly shocking is the political cowardice shown by the Labour government. Labour is traditionally the avocado party.
They are. They skew heavily towards the young and well-educated. Yet, they are making the situation worse.
Why are they doing that? Why target your own core voters?
They're prioritizing tax breaks for pensioners, a demographic that votes reliably and holds significant wealth. Labour believes they can afford to disappoint the young without losing the election, while protecting older voters who are, perhaps paradoxically, more likely to swing back to the Conservatives. It's the politics of least resistance, and the young are paying the bill.
From the financial anxiety of Britain's youth, let's segue into global finance, market froth, and the critical importance of being able to spot a financial bubble before it bursts.
There is serious anxiety surrounding AI stocks, companies like Palantir and Nvidia. The S&P 500 is over 60% pricier relative to sales than it was at the dot-com bubble's peak in 2000.
So by most traditional metrics, we are deep in bubble territory.
The valuations are definitely flashing red, but timing a crash remains the single hardest part of investing. High valuations are good at predicting low long-run returns, but they're useless for predicting the short-run burst.
That's the classic lesson from the late 90s, isn't it?
It is. Brilliant investors like George Soros and Warren Buffett were entirely correct that a bubble existed. But they were wrong for years as the NASDAQ rose nearly 1,100%. Being early is indistinguishable from being wrong in the short term.
So if traditional metrics are useless for timing the burst, what novel indicators can investors use?
Well, we can proxy public mania by looking at Google search trends for investing fads, Bitcoin, SPACs, AI stocks. The idea is the bubble peaks when the general public, the cab drivers and partygoers all pile in.
And what do those search trends show for the current AI mania?
Searches for AI stocks hit their zenith in mid-August. And while prices rose for a few weeks after, searches have since fallen dramatically, just as the stocks themselves are starting to wobble. NVIDIA's share price has fallen by 13% from its peak.
And we also saw a major short seller give up.
Yes. The closure of Michael Burry's fund in late October after he'd been shorting AI stocks is a major buzzkill signal. It's very reminiscent of 2000, when professionals who correctly called the bubble went out of business before the ultimate collapse.
Let's look at the financial pressure on Russia. America implemented new sanctions on December 1st against Russia's biggest oil firms, Lukoil and Rosneft.
Together, they account for half of Russia's crude exports. The goal is clearly to deter buyers in China and India by making the transactions legally toxic.
And is it working? Is it putting Russia under immediate pressure?
It is. India, the main purchaser, cut back purchases after stocking up ahead of the deadline. Analysts estimate Russia's crude shipments could drop by 39%, about 1.4 million barrels a day in the next few months.
But Russian firms are notoriously resourceful at finding workarounds, using that shadow fleet of tankers.
They are already finding ways around it. They're selling more barrels to untargeted, previously obscure third-party traders. These smaller traders then flock the oil to the subcontinent. It allows blacklisted imports to become deniable.
So it's an endless, complex game of whack-a-mole.
It is, but Ukraine is also getting smarter with its kinetic strategy, targeting Russia's energy infrastructure.
That's the critical point, isn't it?
It is. Ukraine's drone strikes are becoming far more strategic. They're bombing the same refiners every 2 to 3 weeks, significantly slowing repairs. And crucially, they're targeting secondary refinery units.
Why is that important?
Because they're far trickier to fix. They require sophisticated, specific Western components that Russia can no longer easily acquire.
And what's the ultimate impact of that?
It could cut Russia's refinery throughput by 7 to 10%. This forces Russia to export more crude, the raw, less valuable product, into an already saturated global market, which will only drive down prices and squeeze their revenue stream.
Shifting to China, the economy is still suffering from profound consumer misery. Retail sales growth slowed for a fifth consecutive month.
And the state's response to this is peculiar and revealing. The Communist Party is focused on increasing the quality of supply rather than boosting demand directly. They believe the issue is latent demand, not a fundamental lack of confidence.
And this leads to those bizarre policies, like promoting immersive experiential shopping and the golden toilets.
Yes. At the DigiPlaza in Nanjing, the sources note that visitors travel hours specifically to see the absurdly decked out, gleaming lavatories. The party is essentially focusing on retail tourism.
But experts argue this fundamentally confuses the issue.
They do. The real culprits were not a lack of glittering malls, but structural economic anxieties. Weak employment, falling wages, and the grinding property crisis, which has made even the middle class feel substantially poorer.
So the state's focus on supply is likely a political tactic to avoid harder choices.
It's a clear attempt to avoid difficult measures that would tilt resources away from their core manufacturing base. It will take more than gleaming lavatories to ease China's serious structural pressures.
Let's end this section on global finance with two significant European trends: the massive pivot in defense spending and the resulting rise of an unexpected financial hub.
Europe is finally serious about defense, driven by Russian aggression and American unreliability. The EU launched SAFE, a 150 billion euro fund for defense investments. It's fully subscribed. NATO allies are aiming to raise spending to 3.5% of GDP by 2035.
And out of this necessity, Stockholm has quietly emerged as Europe's capital of capital.
It's a surprise, given that Frankfurt and Paris were expected to replace London post-Brexit. But Stockholm has succeeded in niche areas like IPOs and high-yield junk bonds.
And the key reason for this ties directly back to that defense spending.
Yes. Sweden's traditionally puritanical, hyper-disciplined budgets are changing drastically due to NATO accession.
Which is creating a bond boom and a bond trader's paradise. Why?
Because the government is opening the fiscal taps. The stock of Sweden's government bonds is set to grow rapidly, from 45 billion krona in 2023 to over 200 billion in 2026. This rapid, huge influx of new supply, coupled with market volatility, is creating immense arbitrage opportunities.
Okay, can you explain what arbitrage means in practice for these traders?
Absolutely. In this context, it just means exploiting small price differences for the same asset. In a volatile market with a huge amount of new supply, there will be mispricings. Because Stockholm's financial ecosystem is smaller and less saturated than New York or London, those mispricings can persist for longer, sometimes minutes instead of milliseconds.
So geopolitical necessity is creating an unexpected economic dividend for bond traders. Now let's transition to our final section, exploring some unique cultural phenomena and scientific frontiers, starting with a grim look at crime.
We have grim details on the forced labor and human trafficking crisis in the Americas. It's become a sophisticated core part of drug gangs' portfolios, leveraging the infrastructure of the cocaine economy.
The scope of the suffering is just shocking. The number of people tricked or forced into work increased by 89% between 2018 and 2022 in countries like Colombia, the Dominican Republic, and Brazil.
The International Labor Organization reckons 3.6 million people are forced to work across the Americas, generating $52 billion annually in illegal profit.
Can you detail the methods of entrapment?
Debt bondage is the most common. There's the case of Isabel, lured with a promise of work, only to have her passport confiscated and be forced into sex work, told she owed $6,000 for her flight. Illegal gold mining is a major area for forced labor for men. In Brazilian gold mines alone, an estimated 4,500 people are exploited.
And what's the role of the internet in escalating this crisis?
The pandemic forced traffickers online, and they realized it was far more effective. Social media allows them to reach more people with less effort. They can build trust over time, gather personal details, and then use that to control them, like threatening victims' children.
And convictions are rare.
Virtually non-existent for labor trafficking in places like Colombia since 2018.
Moving to Brazil, we see a powerful cultural shift, particularly during Black Consciousness Month in November.
This is driven by deep demographic change. The 2022 census revealed that for the first time, more Brazilians identified as brown or black than white. Culturally, interest is booming. Afro-Brazilian religions tripled their membership. In Rio, Little Africa, the birthplace of Samba, now attracts more tourists than Christ the Redeemer.
And that puts Brazil's difficult history into context. Brazil imported a devastating 5 million slaves.
Compared to only about 400,000 in the U.S., this history was literally buried for years, evidenced by the discovery of Valongo Wharf, the biggest slave port in history, during renovations for the Rio Olympics.
And recent genomic studies underscore the brutality of that past.
They do. 71% of male DNA is European, but 42% of female DNA is African. President Lula has acknowledged this, seeking to make amends by rekindling ties with Africa, specifically positioning Brazil to give back what was taken.
And how are they achieving that payback in a practical sense?
Lula is focusing on sharing Brazilian agricultural technology, specifically from the state research corporation Embrapa. It's adapted for similar climate and soil conditions in Central and Western Africa. It's a practical, development-focused effort.
Let's discuss a fascinating, if morally complex, trend, dark tourism. Visiting sites of tragedy, atrocity, or disaster. It's now a $35 billion market.
We're seeing tourists return to places like Syria to witness the scars, the destroyed suburbs, the infamous Sednaya prison known as the Human Slaughterhouse. Local guides are charging significant permit fees.
The central debate here is ethical. Is it educational or is it just voyeurism?
That is the core tension. You have those who seek to bear witness in a sober way versus the voyeurs who take crass selfies at sites like Auschwitz. Social media, especially TikTok, turbocharges this trend.
So the key is distinguishing the intent.
Right. A traveler who genuinely wants to understand is different from a tourist who is just there for the shock value or the social media likes.
Now to science. Autism spectrum disorder, ASD, is not a single condition. The clinical definition unhelpfully groups people with vastly different symptoms under one umbrella.
And that lumping has profoundly hindered research for decades. If you study the entire group, you miss the crucial signals. But new research from Princeton and the Flatiron Institute suggests a way forward by breaking ASD into four scientifically validated subcategories based on genetic profiles.
Which profile stands out as the most distinct?
The social behavioral group is particularly important because it's often diagnosed later. The genes involved often don't switch on until after birth. These children frequently have co-occurring conditions like ADHD and severe depression. Knowing this genetic profile allows for targeted support.
And what about environmental factors?
Their study has been similarly hampered by lumping all sufferers together. Exposure to valproate, an epilepsy medication, in the womb is a well-supported cause. But conclusive evidence for many other factors is lacking precisely because studies lump all autistic people together. Refining the phenotype, splitting the spectrum, is essential.
We've seen bureaucracy struggle globally in our sources. Germany's insistence on using fax machines during COVID, for example.
But we've also seen progress. Greece has taught countries like Germany a lesson in successful digital transformation. Focus on redesigning processes first. Don't just digitize chaos.
That progress contrasts sharply with the challenges facing Western military recruitment. They desperately need more troops, but are facing a severe crisis.
And the problem isn't a lack of patriotism, it's unsuitability. Only 23% of Americans aged 17 to 24 meet the requirements because they're deemed too fat, drugged up, or depressed.
And they've built absurd bureaucratic obstacles on top of that.
Disqualifying recruits for minor issues like acne or ADHD treated in the past, with waivers taking up to 4 years in Britain.
So they are finally lowering standards.
They are. They're lowering fitness tests, intellectual requirements, and offering massive pay rises and bonuses. It's finally leading to modest recruitment upticks, but it comes with a risk of compromising troop quality.
Finally, we need to talk about the concept that defines our current information ecosystem. The word of the year for 2025 is slop.
Slop. It refers to mindlessly entertaining junk or rubbish, spurred by generative AI platforms like OpenAI's Sora, which fill social media with synthetic videos and web pages with AI-written prose. The cost of producing content has plummeted to just a few prompts.
So slop merchants are clogging the internet, and quality sinks across the board. If you search for a health question on Google, the top results are new web pages filled with AI prose, and it's impossible to tell good from bad.
Exactly. This creates a pooling equilibrium, an economic concept.
What does that mean in plain terms for the listener?
It means that in a market where quality is impossible to verify, like buying a used car when you don't know if it's a lemon, the market rewards dishonesty, and honest dealers eventually stop trying. Good products get driven out of the market.
So the market sinks to the lowest common denominator because people can't distinguish quality.
Precisely. But there is a paradoxical positive outcome. Sleeptimism. If the news ecosystem drowns in slop, people will eventually flock to high-quality publications that can prove the authenticity or the chain of custody of their content.
So investing in costly signals like print presses or technologies that flag how content was created provides a competitive advantage.
To organizations that jealously guard their reputation for truth-telling?
Yes.
A truly profound, if unsettling, thought to end on.
We covered an incredible amount of ground today. From the crisis of authority in the U.S. drug war and the fragile transition in Syria, to the volatility of politics in Britain and the radical reshaping of childhood and work by AI.
What stands out across all these sources is this growing crisis of authenticity and verifiability. Whether it's AI-generated content having the power to flip polling results, or the challenges of establishing functional governance when the rule of law is disregarded, societies are struggling to know what is real and who is trustworthy.
That connection between technological distrust and political incivility is crucial. We discussed the concept of sleuptimism, the idea that a flood of junk content might paradoxically force us to recognize and pay for quality. So, given the rapid rise of AI and misinformation, what new costly signals will be required for society to maintain trust in any authority, whether it's a news source, a polling firm, or a politician in the coming years?
That is the ultimate question for the next decade, isn't it? How do you prove you are real in a world drowning in synthetic content?
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into The Economist for the week of December 6th to December 12th, 2025.
Always a pleasure to help synthesize the world's complexities. We hope this knowledge serves you well.